After today, in terms of weeks, we'll be a quarter of the way through the term. But we've only had one exam out of five. And that's because all the rest of the exams are only three chapters each, and they're more focused. But the pace will pick up because of that, as far as tests are concerned. Now it's time to start Unit 2, and it's finally time to start talking in detail about the four categories of macromolecules that we keep mentioning. And remember that those categories are polysaccharides, polypeptides, lipids, and nucleic acids. Now, those are all macromolecules because they're all big molecules. That's what macro means, compared to run-of-the-mill molecules like water, for instance. And they're all indispensable to life. All organisms have to have all four kinds. But although all four of those categories are macromolecules, only three of them officially qualify as polymers. Polymer is a word that means many part. Mer means part, poly means many. And polymers are macromolecules that are made by hooking together a bunch of subunits, each of which is called a monomer, a one-part thing. And I mention that because polymer appears on this opening slide. Although the important thing about this slide actually applies to all four categories. Only three of the categories are polymers, but what's important here really applies even to the fourth, which is not. Anyone know which of the four categories is not a polymer? Right. Lipids are big molecules. They're macromolecules, but they're built a little bit differently. Not by hooking together a bunch of monomers, so they are not polymers. Okay? Still, though, even lipids obey what's being taught here on this opening slide. And what we see here are two different kinds of important reactions. Molecules are being built all the time in cells, and they're also being broken down all the time. At the top of the slide, we see how larger molecules can be made by hooking together smaller pieces. And this is what I was saying, even though it's labeled polymer, still applies even to lipids. If you build a bigger molecule out of smaller pieces, one of those two pieces is going to have a hydrogen sticking off somewhere, the other one's going to have an OH sticking off of it somewhere. And those are important because it allows for a specific kind of reaction to occur that will link the two parts. The name of the reaction is called a dehydration reaction, which means removal of water, right? Dehydration is removal of water. That applies here. It makes sense because one of those two pieces is going to lose the hydrogen, the other piece is going to lose the OH, and an H and an OH together form water that comes out. This allows, though, if you imagine this in ball and stick terms, removing a hydrogen from one piece and an OH from the other piece is going to leave two sticks, right? And that allows the two pieces then to be covalently bonded together. So 1, 2, 3, and 4 are now together in a bigger piece. Dehydration, in other words, allows for building bigger molecules. Just the opposite can occur and has to occur. And it's in every respect the opposite. Instead of water coming out to build a bigger molecule out of smaller pieces, water is going to be required in order to split a big molecule into smaller pieces. So it is exactly the reverse of dehydration. The reason water is required is because water itself is going to be split to supply one of the two pieces with a hydrogen and the other piece with an OH. And that's not dehydration, that's called hydrolysis, a word that linguistically means water splitting. Not only is the water itself split, but it allows for the big molecule to be split into two pieces. right? This, well, I'll talk about that in a different chapter. I'll have plenty of time to get to that. But that's the important thing here in slide one. So that's a general slide that applies to all four categories. Now it's time to, category by category, take a closer look at each of these kinds of macromolecules. Starting, as far as categories are concerned, with polysaccharides, although none of these things that we're looking at in slide two is a polysaccharide. Polysaccharide, by the way, the name indicates that it's a polymer. You might have been taught, if you ever learned these categories of macromolecules before, that one of the categories is carbohydrates. That's not true. Carbohydrates is a more general term. Carbohydrates includes simple sugars and complex sugars. Simple sugars are not macromolecules. They are monomers that can be hooked together to build the polymer that we call a polysaccharide. But monosaccharides themselves, which are carbohydrates, are not macromolecules. That's why if you're naming the categories of macromolecules, instead of saying carbohydrates, only some of which are large, you should say polysaccharides. All polysaccharides are large. All right? All of these are monosaccharides, so they are important in their own right, just as individual molecules, but monosaccharides also can be used as building blocks that you hook together to form polysaccharides. You built glucose with your ball and stick models, but glucose is just one of many, many monosaccharides. Remember, though, when you did build glucose that you used a pair of springs, right? Because there was what kind of functional group? That's what the springs represent, but what functional group required that spring? The carbonyl group. Every monosaccharide has a carbonyl somewhere. But remember, when we studied the functional groups, there's two different categories of carbonyl-containing compounds depending on where that carbonyl is with respect to the carbon skeleton. You remember talking about this? And what are the two categories? Ketones and aldehydes. Well, since every monosaccharide has a carbonyl, that means every monosaccharide is either an aldehyde or a ketone. And so the rows of this table show you one of two ways being displayed here that you can categorize monosaccharides. You can categorize them based on whether they are a ketone or an aldehyde. Okay? And so this top row, this is not an exhaustive list, this is just four of many, many possible aldehyde sugars, and that's exactly what aldoses, the name of the category, means. Words that end in O-S-E tell you that that's a sugar, a monosaccharide or a polysaccharide. Well, aldoses simply means aldehyde sugars. Ketoses are ketone sugars, and you can see the difference by comparing where the carbonyl groups are that are highlighted in orange here, or salmon, whatever. Okay, the columns, on the other hand, are a completely different way of categorizing monosaccharides. It has nothing to do with where the carbonyl is. It's just a different way of categorizing them. And what the columns indicate is that you can categorize monosaccharides based on the number of carbons that they contain. In other words, the size of the carbon skeleton. So glyceraldehyde and dihydroxyacetone are both trioses, tri meaning three. They both have three carbons. There are many pentoses, there are many hexoses. The glucose that you build is just one of many hexoses. And by the way, hexoses are all isomers of each other. They all have exactly the same chemical formula, C6H12O6. All pentoses have the same chemical formula. They're isomers of each other and so on. All right, three. In 3, we can see what you built on the left. You built a hexose, you built glucose, and actually it's the size of it doesn't matter. It's nothing special about 6. But what's important here is that you built for your monosaccharide what is called the linear form. Any given monosaccharide can exist in either of 2 forms, and it can flip back and forth between those 2 forms many times per second, which is why you have double arrows here. All right? The linear form means not necessarily that it's a perfect line, just that there are 2 ends to the skeleton. It doesn't form a ring. But you can form a ring. That sugar, which will be called the same thing when this happens, can exist in ringed form or cyclic form as well. All right? And this will be important in today's lab, which I'll mention again later. But that's why we have the double arrows. If this is a monosaccharide on its own, at any given moment, it could be either of these 2 forms. All right, now we're getting closer to actually looking at a polysaccharide, although these aren't even polysaccharides because they're not big enough. In slide 4, we can see the building of a couple disaccharides. Di means 2, so if you hook just 2 monosaccharides together, you form a slightly more complex sugar called a disaccharide. A general term meaning multiple monosaccharides hooked together, but not necessarily yet many, is oligosaccharide. Oligo means a few, but not many, like oligarchy, ruled by several people, but not many, as opposed to a monarchy. Although that's only disaccharides being built here, there's no reason you have to stop there. So the important point of this slide is that to build a polysaccharide, you use the same method shown here, just many times, to hook a bunch of monosaccharides together. To hook any 2 monosaccharides together, though, uses the information that we looked at in the first slide, meaning that there's going to be a dehydration reaction to hook the 2 together. One of the 2 pieces is going to lose a hydrogen, the other is going to lose an OH. That's why water comes out, and that allows the 2 monosaccharides to be hooked together. Okay, you can see that happening in the upper left here. Now, in the case of monosaccharides specifically being hooked this way through a dehydration reaction, we call the resulting covalent bond a special name. That is called a glycosidic linkage. Glyco is a word form that means sugar. So you see that in several words that we'll encounter later. Okay, so there's a glycosidic linkage in maltose, which is made from a glucose and another glucose. It's brewer's sugar, maltose. But what we usually mean when we simply say sugar, meaning table sugar, is another disaccharide, sucrose, which you can make by the same technique, a dehydration reaction, to form a glycosidic linkage between glucose and fructose, 2 different monosaccharides. An important point that you can also see from this slide is that any given monosaccharide has multiple places where there's an H or an OH, meaning there are multiple places on the same monosaccharide that could be used to form a glycosidic linkage with another monosaccharide. And the reason that's important is that this means when you build a polysaccharide, it can be branched. Since there's not just one place you can hook it onto the next, which would mean that it would just be unbranched, polysaccharides don't have to be, but they can be branched if you use more than one place on the same monosaccharide to connect to other monosaccharides. Well, we see that actually in slide 5. Both of these examples have branches in them, although the one on the right has many more branches. That's because of multiple places on each monosaccharide that can be used for dehydration reactions to form glycosidic linkages. The main point of this slide, though, and we finally are at polysaccharide stage. These are officially polysaccharides because there's a hell of a lot of monomers here. Each of these monomers, by the way, happens to be glucose. Each of these little green hexagons represents one glucose, a cyclic version. That doesn't have to be true for polysaccharides, by the way. Polysaccharides can be made by hooking together any kind of monosaccharides. But in biology, glucose is often used as a monomer to build polymers. All right, now, there are two, biologically speaking, major categories of polysaccharides that organisms use and produce. And it's a functional distinction, meaning it's based on how the polysaccharides are used by the organisms. And the two categories are storage polysaccharides and structural polysaccharides. We see only one example here, even though there are two different molecules here, actually more than, there's three different molecules shown here. They're all versions of polysaccharides, but they're also, more specifically, all examples of storage polysaccharides. You don't see a structural polysaccharide here yet. We will in the next slide. Storage polysaccharides are called storage polysaccharides because what is being stored when they're built is energy. One of the major uses in organisms of monosaccharides is that they are the main fuel in cells. It's the most often used fuel. And specifically, although there's many monosaccharides, glucose is the master fuel in all cells for all organisms. All right, so that is the chief fuel in your body, for instance, and when it comes to your, although the rest of your body besides your brain can use different kinds of fuels, your brain actually can use, unless you're starving, under normal circumstances, it will use nothing but glucose as its fuel, which is why we have things in our body, we have mechanisms in our body to ensure that our blood glucose level remains within limits. If your brain gets starved of glucose, you're dead, which is why the rest of your body will be told, use something else, keep the glucose for the brain. But in general, no matter what the organism, even for unicellular organisms, glucose is the master fuel. And so that's what we'll be talking about, the use of glucose as a fuel when we get to Unit 3. But for this chapter, the reason that these polysaccharides are called storage polysaccharides is that it's a way to store extra glucose that you don't need to burn as fuel at the moment, but you want to store it because it's valuable stuff. And by hooking them all together for temporary storage, it's a lot more efficient in the cell because you get rid of all those waters. It makes it smaller. All right? Well, just two, there's more groups of organisms than just animals and plants, but in this slide we're comparing how plants do this to compared to how we animals do it. Plants, when they have extra glucose on hand, then we'll stick them together a certain way to form a storage polysaccharide called starch. And we animals do largely the same thing. This is a major function of your liver. You know, after a meal, which has a bunch of glucose in it, no matter what you're eating, pretty much. After that digestion occurs and then absorption into your body occurs, your glucose level in your blood is going to go up from because it came from the meal. So you're going to have more than you need. And so the liver will take the extra glucose out of your blood, hook them together to form the animal version of storage polysaccharide, which is glycogen, with the intent, and the reason it's a storage polysaccharide, with the intent of using it later. Well, to use it as fuel, it has to be in monosaccharide form. You don't burn glycogen, but glycogen can then be disassembled later on. When it's hours later and you haven't eaten, now your blood glucose level is starting to drop, which would kill you because your brain needs constant glucose. So your liver will reverse the process, break down the glycogen that it made before into individual glucose molecules, put that into the blood so the brain stays alive and therefore you stay alive. This, by the way, is why glycogen, animal version, compared to starch, plant version, is more highly branched. The more branches you have, the more tips there are from which you can pick one at a time of these glucoses off. So it's a faster process, which is more important for active animals than it is for plants. But those are storage polysaccharides. Slide 6. Well, we see starch. This is the same thing we looked at before, but this is a structural formula showing a close-up of just some of its size on the left, and cellulose on the right. They look very similar. They're both made of nothing but glucose monomers, and they're both polysaccharides, but they are functionally different. Whereas starch, as I said, is a storage polysaccharide, cellulose is an example of a structural polysaccharide. Structural polysaccharides are built for the purpose of being some sort of structural element. So not for storing the energy. They're built more or less permanently. Of course, they can be broken down as well, but the organism builds them for a more permanent purpose, not to store the fuel, because not with the intent of dismantling them later for burning as fuel, but to stay there as a structural element. Well, I told you at the beginning of the chapter that any given monosaccharide exists in two forms, linear and ringed. Actually, it's even more complex than that. Notice that glucose, even in the ringed form, has two different versions. And this is because of chirality, actually. Notice that alpha-glucose, so-called alpha-glucose, is almost identical to beta-glucose. The only difference is where this OH that's associated with carbon number 1 is placed. In this one, it's above the plane. This one, it's below the plane. That's the only difference between the two. They're both glucose, but they're two different versions of ringed glucose. And that matters when it comes to building a polysaccharide. If you use glycosidic linkages between alpha-glucose monomers, you're making starch. If you do the same thing but use beta-glucose monomers, then you make a structural polysaccharide, cellulose. I shouldn't say you do, because that cellulose is a plant-made structural polysaccharide. And in 7, we can see that an individual polymer of cellulose is a long strand which can be put in parallel, side by side, bundled together with a bunch of other more or less identical cellulose strands to form a much stronger rope-like structure. It's a structural element, so it's not there for the purpose of storing the energy, even though the energy is there. Those glucoses could be used for energy, it's just not the intent. All right, now in 8, we see a fellow mammal, this cow, that is eating grass, and grass, of course, are plants, and plants have a lot of cellulose because, as we'll see later, in addition to the plasma membrane that every kind of cell has, plant cells have a layer outside of that, which is much thicker and stronger than the plasma membrane. That's called the cell wall. And the chief component, molecularly speaking, of the cell wall is cellulose. So if you eat plants, you're taking in a bunch of cellulose. Now, the reason that's interesting and the reason the slide's here is that cellulose, as I've told you, is not really nothing but glucoses, all of which are very valuable fuel, But you can't use starch as fuel, you can't use cellulose as fuel, because you have to break it into individual glucoses. Glucose is the fuel, only when it's on its own. Well, we can easily break down starch, which is why we get energy from starch. But we animals actually can't break the glycosidic linkages between the glucose monomers that make up cellulose. So even though cellulose is chock full of potential energy, we can't get any nutrition from it, which is why it's considered roughage for us. It just passes through us. We cannot digest or break those bonds between the celluloses. So we can't absorb it into the body. It's too big. But a cow gets around this. Now, a cow is, like I said, a fellow mammal, just like us. It does not have the ability to break these bonds. But it does get useful energy from the cellulose it eats, because in one of its stomachs, it houses a species of bacteria, and those bacteria are able to break these bonds. All right? This is an example of symbiosis, which is an ecology term. Osis means condition, bio means life, sim means together. So it's the condition of living together. Symbiosis is a close arrangement between two different species. They live together. Now this is even more specifically a case of endosymbiosis. Endo meaning within, because one of those two species lives inside the other organism. And even more specifically, this is an example of mutualistic endosymbiosis. Mutualism is one kind of symbiosis in which both of the two involved species benefit from the arrangement. That doesn't have to be true. Parasitism, for instance, benefits one but not the other. Well, in mutualism, both of them benefit. The bacteria that live in the stomachs, or one of the stomachs at least, of the cow, clearly benefits. It gets a continuous supply of free food as long as the cow is grazing, living in a nice, moist, warm, constant environment, the stomach. And the bacterium is not trying to break down the cellulose for the cow's benefit. It's just living. It's doing it for its own benefit, and it's using some of that glucose. But because it's breaking so much cellulose apart, there's plenty of glucose also that can be absorbed by the cow, so it benefits as well. By the way, the reason that we as animals can't break these bonds is that we don't have the right kind of protein acting as an enzyme to break those bonds. Why is it that we can't make that protein? Or in general, why is it that there is any kind of protein that we can't make? What has to be true for an organism to be able to build a protein? DNA. Right, you have to have the gene. That's the job of a gene, is to code indirectly for how to build a protein. We animals don't have that gene. If we acquired that gene, either artificially or through mutation, then we would be able to directly break down cellulose, wouldn't have to rely on the bacteria. In slide 9, we see that structural polysaccharides are not made only by plants. There are animal versions as well, including chitin, which is how this word is spelled. Chitin is found in the exoskeletons of insects. That's one place. Exoskeletons are called that because the hard part of organisms with exoskeletons are like armor. The hard part is external. Our hard parts are internal, right? And we have soft, so we have an endoskeleton. But the exoskeleton of an insect is chiefly composed of chitin, which is an animal version of a structural polysaccharide, and it is so strong that we take advantage of it by using it to make surgical thread in some cases. All right, that is a brief overview of polysaccharides. Now the next major category of macromolecules. Starts in slide 10. What are we looking at here? Which of the four categories would you say?
Lipids.
Yes. So remember, lipids are different in that they are not polymers, but they are macromolecules. And there are many different kinds of lipids that are important for various reasons, only one of which we're looking at here. And the bottom, this gray and orange structure that we see on the bottom, is an example of a fat. This is one fat that we're seeing on the bottom. That's just one type of lipid. So don't make the common mistake of equating the word fat and lipid. All fats are lipids, but not all lipids are fats. Okay, so fats is a subset of lipids. An individual fat molecule, which we see an example of here on the bottom, can go by any of three interchangeable names. The easiest one to say and to spell is fat, but the word doesn't really by itself tell you much about it. The other two words that you could use instead of fat are triglyceride, and that's what most biologists would call a fat, or you can also call it a triacyl glycerol, which is what most biochemists would call it. Triacyl glycerol is really the most descriptive. Notice that it ends in OL, meaning alcohol, right? Tri, of course, means three, and that's shown in both words, triglyceride and triacyl glycerol. Triglycerol is pretty descriptive as well. Notice how a fat is built. Even though it's not a polymer, it still has smaller parts that it's built out of. And in the case of a fat, any fat, and there's different kinds of fats, any fat includes four parts, one of which is the part up above shown just in gray. Notice it's labeled as glycerol, which tells you that that molecule by itself is an alcohol. What makes it an alcohol? The fact that it has a hydroxyl. Well, it actually has three hydroxyls, so it's triply an alcohol. But glycerol just by itself is already a complete molecule. Ignore the orange. Okay? It can exist by a molecule on its own. But because it has these three hydroxyls, each of which, of course, has a hydrogen, there are three connection points that it has where you can use a dehydration reaction to connect something to it. And so to build a fat, you connect three things to this glycerol, each of which is an example of a fatty acid. A fatty acid is also a molecule by itself, if it's on its own. And just one is shown here in orange. Now notice that a fatty acid has an OH, and so the fatty acid is going to lose an OH, the glycerol is going to lose an H, and that allows the two to be covalently bonded. All right? Now, if you did that and that's all, you would be forming a monoglyceride. But if you do it for all three connection points on the glycerol, meaning connect three fatty acids to that same glycerol, then you form a triglyceride. That's a complete fat. When you look at just the fatty acid, ignore the glycerol, this is an example of a molecule that is almost, but not quite, a hydrocarbon, right? A fatty acid is not actually a hydrocarbon because this oxygen at these oxygens at the end ruin it. What is this functional group that's... I said hydroxyl, but it's actually not a hydroxyl. What functional group is at the end of this fatty acid and any fatty acid group? It's a carboxyl. So really, a fatty acid could be described as a hydrocarbon chain with a carboxyl at the end. So that's carboxyl makes it really not a hydrocarbon overall. But since it's mostly a hydrocarbon, that means there's a bunch of carbon-hydrogen bonds. And that is what makes hydrocarbons, in general, very good fuels. Right? This is why we burn gasoline as a fuel. Gasoline is just a mixture of a bunch of hydrocarbons. And the reason that those hydrocarbons in general are excellent fuels is because there's a lot of potential chemical energy locked up in carbon-carbon and carbon-hydrogen bonds, which is all you have in hydrocarbon. This makes fatty acids have a high energy density for an organism. The energy density is how much energy is available in a given mass, say a gram of the stuff. And compared to, there's three major nutrient classes when you think about it dietarily. Carbohydrates, fats, and proteins. Compared to proteins and carbohydrates, fats have a much higher energy density. More than twice as much energy is stored per gram of fat than is stored in a gram of either protein or carbohydrate. Which is why when we take more energy in as food than we need, that we're going to burn at the time, we've evolved to save that stuff because over evolutionary history, humans have been starving mostly. It's not so much an issue now, but we're still obeying what we've evolved for. Save that energy for later. And the most efficient way of doing that is to store it in the form that is the most energy dense. So it can come in as whatever, whether it's protein, carbohydrate, or fat in the meal. We're going to turn it into fat if we don't need it to burn it as fuel for that minute. You know, candy manufacturers love to put no fat on the label, which is true. It's pure sugar in a lot of cases. But if you're taking in more than you need, your body is going to turn that sugar into fat to store it. If we stored our extra energy as protein or as carbohydrate instead of as fat, then we would have to weigh a lot more than we do to hold that same amount of energy. And that would make it more expensive for us to move around, which would be wasteful. All right, now back to this fat. These are rich sources of energy. That's not the only thing that fats are used for, though. Fats are also good padding. They make for good padding material. Cells that are specialized to store a bunch of fat are called adipocytes, fat cells. And those are, you know, we have them around our kidneys, for instance, packing material. You sit on fat pads, which protects deeper structures from damage. And another major use of fats is that they are good thermal insulation material. And so they can keep the body either cool or warmer than the environment, depending on what it is.
What was the fat cell again?
Adipocyte. Yeah, adipose tissue, which is fat tissue, is made up of cells that are called adipocytes. Site meaning cell. All right, now, I said that there are different kinds of fats, which is true. This shows you just one kind of fat. And this one just happens to be, this happens to be a fat that uses the same fatty acid, palmitic acid, for all three positions. That doesn't have to be true. As long as it's a fatty acid, you can use the same, two of one and one of another, or all three different fatty acids. There are different kinds of fatty acids, in other words, which is why there are different kinds of fats. Glycerol is always the same. The fats are different only because fatty acids come in different varieties. Now, looking at this slide, can you figure out a way in which a fatty acid can be different from this one that's shown? How could you have a fatty acid still be a fatty acid but be different from palmitic acid? Exactly. There's nothing saying you have to stop here at your carbon, right? It can be longer or shorter. As long as it has this carboxyl, the hydrocarbon chain can be as long or short as you want. So that's one important way in which there can be different kinds of fatty acids and therefore different kinds of fats. But there's another important way. Notice that palmitic acid, and it's not the only one like this, but in this example, every one of these carbon-carbon bonds in the chain is a single bond. Well, that doesn't have to be true either. So if we look at slide 11, we can see on the bottom that this fatty acid, highlighted in orange, has a double bond. By the way, these squiggles, that's not just artwork. This is shorthand biochemistry notation. In biochemistry, biochemists are always drawing structural formulae, and so they got sick of doing all the detail pretty quickly. And so they said, there's so many carbons and hydrogens, why do we bother labeling these things? Let's just label any other kind of atom, since there's fewer of them. And any time that there is a corner or an end, that means there's a carbon there. Okay, so every one of these corners of the squiggle, or the zigzag, I mean, is a carbon. And then just because of valence rules, you have to imagine, well, there's as many hydrogens as are required to satisfy everything. They're just not shown for simplicity. This double bar here, though, represents a double bond between the carbon. If I temporarily go back to the previous slide, if you imagine making a double bond between these two carbons with a ball and stick model, the only way you can do that is to make a hole in each of these, right? Which means you're going to have to remove hydrogens from them. So this explains the name of the names used to describe different fatty acids based on not on size, but on whether or not there are double bonds. Any given fatty acid is either a saturated fatty acid or an unsaturated fatty acid. Saturated as a word means full of something, right? Like a saturated towel can't get any wetter. It's holding as much water as possible. Well, if a fatty acid has only single bonds between the carbons all along its length, then that means it's going to be able to hold the maximum number of hydrogens to fill those empty holes. So that's why we call that kind of fatty acid a saturated fatty acid. It's saturated with hydrogen, but it means that there's only single bonds. And if a fatty acid is saturated, which all those are in 10, and which the ones on the top are in 11, then that makes the fatty acid nice and straight. An unsaturated fatty acid is any fatty acid that has at least one double bond. It can have more than one double bond, which is why we have the word polyunsaturated that you might find on food labels. Polyunsaturated fats, for instance. That means that there's multiple double bonds. But as long as there's at least one, then that means there is now a bend in the fatty acid. And that makes a difference when it comes to how these things pack together. And I usually use the analogy of bent, either not bent or bent wires. So think of some fairly stiff wire like coat hangers. If each one represents a fatty acid. If you have a bunch of straight wires, and they can all be different lengths because fatty acids can differ in their length as well. But as long as they're all unbent, which would be saturated fatty acids, you could kind of haphazardly throw those into a box and they would stack neatly against each other, right? With very little space between them because they're not bent. But if you had the same number of wires, each of which is bent, and especially if they're bent at different places along their length, you try to throw those into a box, they're not going to stack together neatly. There's going to be a bunch of space between them. Well, when you build a fat, you use fatty acids, of course. And so just as there are fatty acids that are saturated and fatty acids that are unsaturated, there are fat. We use those same words for fats. A saturated fat is one in which all three fatty acids are saturated. An unsaturated fat is one in which at least one of the three fatty acids is unsaturated. It doesn't have to be all three. All right. Saturated fatty acids pack together more densely, though. Animals like us produce mostly saturated fats out of saturated fatty acids. And that's why fats taken from animals, like butter, tend to be more solid at room temperature, because they pack together more closely. Plants make most of their fats out of unsaturated fatty acids, so their fats are unsaturated, and those, therefore, being looser, are more liquid at room temperature. Those are oils. They're still fats, just in a different degree of saturation. All right, now we're still in lipids, but we're out of fats. Slide 12 looks kind of like a fat, has important similarities to a fat, but this is not a fat. The reason it's not a fat is because there aren't three things connected to the glycerol, right? There is a glycerol in this molecule, though, just like there is in a fat. Here's the glycerol. Three connection points. But in this molecule, only two of those connection points is used to hook a fatty acid. There are two fatty acids on this molecule, not three. And the third connection point is used to connect to a phosphate, which in turn is connected to other things, depending on the molecule. But it has a phosphate. So this particular lipid is called a phospholipid for that reason. And phospholipids are impossible to overstate the importance of. No organism could exist without phospholipids, which is just one of four major reasons why phosphate groups as a functional group are indispensable to life. Remember I said that they're also found in DNA and RNA. You can't have any DNA or RNA without phosphates. You also can't have any ATP, the main energy carrier. You also can't phosphorylate and dephosphorylate proteins to turn them on or off. But also, and this might be the most important reason, you can't have a cell without phospholipids. Remember, a cell is really defined by its plasma membrane, because a cell is really just a subset of the universe. There's a boundary between it and the rest of the universe. That boundary is the plasma membrane. And molecularly, the main component of any cell's plasma membrane, any cell that's ever existed, going back over 4 billion years, is phospholipids. It's a group of phospholipids. The reason that this is such a special molecule is because it is an example of a molecule that is said to be amphipathic. Now, the pathic part of this word refers to feeling. Of course, the molecule doesn't have any feeling, but we're giving it human qualities just for the sake of describing it. So the same root as in empathy or sympathy, pathetic. The amphi, what does that mean? Anyone know? Yeah, it means dual or both. In amphibian, for instance. The word amphibian, the bi part, like in biology, means life. Amphibian means dual lifestyle. Organism that spends some of its lifetime on land, some of its lifetime in water. An amphitheater, partly indoors, partly outdoors. Well, amphipathic means having dual preference or dual feeling. We use that word to describe molecules that are polar on one part of the molecule and nonpolar on another part of that same molecule. All right. Therefore, one end likes to interact with the polar end, likes to interact with other polar things, and does not like to interact with nonpolar things. But the nonpolar part of that same amphipathic molecule likes to interact with nonpolar molecules and tries to avoid polar molecules. Now, I didn't mention it, but I should have, that when we were talking about fats, is that fats are nonpolar. What is it that makes fats nonpolar? Well, what did we say fatty acids almost are?
Hydrocarbons.
Hydrocarbons in general, whether they're in organisms or just in industry, hydrocarbons are nonpolar. What is it that makes anything nonpolar, nonpolar? Exactly. Hydrocarbons have nothing but carbon-carbon bonds or carbon-hydrogen bonds. A carbon-carbon bond is obviously nonpolar, right? Because two carbons have identical electronegativities. Well, carbon and hydrogen don't have identical electronegativities, but when you look up the values, they're damn close. So a carbon-hydrogen bond is also nonpolar, and that's the only kinds of bonds that are in hydrocarbons. That's why gasoline doesn't mix with water. And neither does fat. Neither does oil, for instance, which is a fat that will float on water. Okay, so fats, which this isn't, are nonpolar. But a phospholipid, which we're looking at, being amphipathic, is partly polar and partly nonpolar. Well, there's two fatty acids, and they are the nonpolar part of a phospholipid, just like they are what make the fat a nonpolar molecule. These carbon-hydrogen bonds are nonpolar, and therefore we say that the tails are hydrophobic, which linguistically means fearing water. Of course, they don't really have any fear, but what it means is that nonpolar molecules don't like to be around polar molecules, and water, of course, is polar. Okay, so hydrophobic means water avoiding. The phosphate, though, recall, when you think back to the functional groups, includes the phosphorus atom and four oxygen atoms, but those oxygen atoms, a couple of them are ionized, O negative here. So that's even beyond polar, right? That's fully charged. It's polar plus, in a sense. So the phosphate head, as it's called, of a phospholipid, is what makes that end of the molecule hydrophilic, water-loving, literally, but it just means that it will mix easily with water, which is polar. We usually cartoonize these molecules simply by drawing a globular hydrophilic head with two tails on it, denoting the fatty acid hydrophobic tails. Well, here's why we can't, and no organism can exist without these remarkable molecules. A phospholipid is not a living thing. It's just a molecule, right? And it's one of the many organic molecules that were accumulating before life. Remember we talked about that experiment to mimic the early Earth's history? So for 800 million years in the oceans, there was just accumulating all these different kinds of organic macromolecules that organisms will require. The organisms don't exist yet. So no, there's no life yet. Well, if you take millions of phospholipids, none of which is alive, and you put them into pure water, which is not alive, the phospholipids will self-assemble into what we see here in, what is that, 13? Which is a phospholipid bilayer. It's two layers of phospholipids. Each one is called a monolayer, but together they form a bilayer. And and you're seeing just part of it. In three dimensions, it would form a perfect sphere, two-layered sphere. The reason it forms is because all of these fatty acid tails are hydrophobic. They do not want to be next to polar water. So the monolayer forms next to the next monolayer so that the tails are next to the tails. That way, the water inside the bag or outside of the bag isn't going to be in direct contact with these hydrophobic fatty acid tails. And both monolayers have their heads, which are hydrophilic, directly in contact with water, which is perfectly fine for them. That's where they want to be. That's why these form. And so this will, you can do this still, and that's how the first cell-like structures came into existence. Once you had enough phospholipids being built by chemical means, there was just so many of them in the ocean that they started forming little cell-like structures. It's not a complete cell yet, but that's how the that's how the plasma membranes began. 14 is another important category of lipids. We looked at something similar to this before. Anyone know what it is?
Cholesterol,
which just by coincidence someone left this word up here. I don't know why, but it matched up well. Yes, this is cholesterol, which is an animal lipid. Plants make similar structures called phytosterols. But they are both versions of steroids or sterols. Notice that sterol means they're alcohols, right? This is an alcohol and has an OH on it. Cholesterol is indispensable to animals for various reasons. What reasons did I already mention? What do we animals do with cholesterol? We use it as the precursor molecule to make all of our steroid hormones. Remember I showed you estrogen and testosterone? Well, we don't make those by hooking together a bunch of things. We start with cholesterol first. And then we just slightly modify the functional groups on cholesterol to turn it into any of the various steroid hormones. Not just estrogen and testosterone, but others as well, like cortisol. That's just one reason why we can't live without it. But also, cholesterol is an important component of plasma membranes in animal cells. By packing those cholesterol molecules in between phospholipids, we can adjust the fluidity of the membrane. I'll talk more about that in a different chapter. All right, that is two of the four categories. We've been through polysaccharides and lipids now. Brings us to slide 15, which begins the proteins section. Now, I'll explain why later, but for now, I'll explain more of this later, but for now, I use the word protein and polypeptide more or less interchangeably. They're not actually always interchangeable words. And that's what I'll explain later in a different chapter. Or is it this chapter? Anyway, I'll explain it later. For now, they mean roughly the same thing. Polypeptide, though, is the word that you should use for the one of the four categories. Even though it's technically correct to say protein as well. Anyway, proteins are, like any of these four categories, indispensable. No organism can live without any of the four categories. But proteins are especially important simply because there is such a huge variety of functions that they perform in cells. Just about any kind of process that's occurring in a cell is going to involve proteins. Now, it could involve other things as well, but the proteins are really doing almost all of the important stuff in cells. And as I've already said multiple times, proteins are what actually give organisms their traits, right? Not the DNA, not the genes, at least not directly. The genes just tell the cells how to build the proteins, but it's the proteins that actually give the organisms their traits in it. And proteins have, compared to the other three categories, a much more diverse set of functions. That's the point of this slide. You can see several different, radically different categories of functions that proteins perform.
And I usually don't read tables to you, but I'll read some of this just to make the point.
For instance, there are enzymes, enzymatic proteins. Enzymatic proteins is really a redundant phrase because all enzymes are proteins. Anyway, I'm sure you've heard the word enzyme before. We'll talk much more about them. But an enzyme in biology is a protein that acts as a catalyst. And I'll be talking much more about catalysts as well. But catalysts are things that speed up chemical reactions. That's enough to know for now. So that's one major job of proteins. And you could say it's the major function of proteins. Do you have a feel for how many different kinds of proteins you can make as a human? There is no limit to the number of proteins that can be made, but we are stuck with only certain kinds of proteins that we're able to make because we have to have the instructions for how to make them, and that's what our genes are. So do you have a feel for how many genes you have? Or have you read this, anyone? Well, are we talking about tens, hundreds, millions? Any idea? Okay. It actually turns out that we have far fewer than we originally thought. We didn't know until we finished 15 years ago or so the Human Genome Project, when we first successfully sequenced the DNA of humans. We thought we had many more, but it's roughly 20,000 protein-coding genes in the human genome. And so that's roughly how many proteins we make. Well, a big fraction of those 20,000 are used as enzymes. I've mentioned that the sum of all the chemical reactions in an organism is called what? Metabolism, which is really life. Well, there are thousands of different kinds of reactions, not just thousands of reactions. There's trillions of reactions happening in you. But there's thousands of different categories of reactions. And each one of those reactions, almost every one of them, requires its own catalyst to make it happen fast enough to stay alive. That's why proteins working as enzymes are so important. By the way, I should have mentioned before I started with the specific functions, any function that a protein has relies on its shape. In other words, any given protein has a specific function. It doesn't change. There's not one protein that can do all of these things. Any individual protein has one specific job. But whatever the job is that a protein has, it's able to perform that job because it has a specific shape. And this is why proteins have such a diverse set of functions, because compared to the other three categories of macromolecules, proteins have the richest variety of possible shapes. There's really no limit if you were designing things to the number of shapes you could make if you used proteins. Okay? And enzymes rely on that shape because enzymes have to bind to specific molecules with just the right complementary shape, like a lock and a key. There are also structural proteins. This is a big function of proteins in organisms in general. Each of these has examples of silk fibers. Collagen is a big part of your body. Important in your skin, but it's structure. Storage proteins are important, but compared to these others, are probably not as important. Egg white, for instance, is protein for the purpose of storing energy. Now, proteins can, or the amino acids that proteins are made out of, can be used as fuel, but it's kind of the back burner fuel in case you don't have anything else to burn. Sugars are the most important, monosaccharides like I talked about. Then we go to fats. When we run out of glycogen, which means ran out of monosaccharides, well, this is the so-called hitting the wall if you're a marathoner. You've used up all your glycogen and you can feel it, because then you have to go to burning fats, which takes a little bit of time to dismantle them into the fatty acids that you can use as fuel. Well, once you use all your body fat, this would be starvation conditions, you have no choice then but to start taking apart the structural components of your body and your muscles, which are made of proteins, to use those as fuel. But egg white is an exception to that. It's supposed to be for storage of fuel to begin with. Transport proteins. Transport means movement. Well, in this case, we're talking about carrying things around. It's a major function of your blood, which is a complex tissue. It's connective tissue. So any connective tissue has cells of some sort, and then stuff around the cells, between the cells, called extracellular matrix. For blood, the cells are the blood cells, of course, and the extracellular matrix is called plasma. And the plasma is mostly water, but suspended in that water are many kinds of so-called plasma proteins. Those carry things around. And also, the blood cells themselves, or the red blood cells, the erythrocytes, are chock full of another protein called hemoglobin, whose job it is to carry around oxygen and carbon dioxide. So there's transport proteins, not just for humans, I'm just using humans as an example. Hormones can be proteins. Not all hormones are proteins, but actually most of them are protein-based, or at least amino acid-based, which proteins are made out of. The steroid hormones are exception to that. Steroid hormones are lipids. So they still work as hormones, which are chemical signals, so they don't do anything, right? Just like any signal, chemical signal, doesn't do anything to a cell unless it has the right kind of receptor. Well, the protein hormones are actually too big to get through a plasma membrane. So they have to have their receptors located on the exterior of the cell in order to bind to it. They kind of knock on the door of the cell, in a sense. Whereas lipids are able to slip right through the plasma membrane, which is because those hydrophobic tails are just like lipids. And so steroid hormones go fully into the cell and sometimes into the nucleus, and that's where they find their receptors. Anyway, proteins act as hormones. Well, whether a hormone, or other signals for that matter, are protein or not, the receptors in all cases are proteins. So some proteins are acting as hormones, and then you have other proteins acting as the receptors for those proteins because of their shape. Contractile and motor proteins, this also has to do with movement, but here we're not talking about carrying things from one place to another. We're talking about movement, changes in shape of the cell. This is how your skeletal muscles work. Skeletal muscles can only pull. No muscle can push. I mean, you can push on a wall, but you're doing that by having one muscle get shorter, which, because they're connected to bones, causes leverage. But anyway, muscles are able to get shorter because there are protein fibers in those that are increasing the overlap between themselves, and that causes the cell to get shorter. So that's totally different use of proteins. And then finally on this list, we have defensive proteins. You know, getting a vaccination for COVID or for whatever reason is a way to stimulate your body into making specific kinds of antibodies. We make antibodies naturally just by being exposed to things, but a vaccination simply tells the body, make this particular kind of antibody to defend us against this particular thing. Well, antibodies are proteins. Each individual kind of antibody recognizes one particular kind of thing in your body that shouldn't be there, that is not you, and therefore maybe needs to be destroyed. That's why it protects you. They work for immunity. Okay. I actually didn't expect to get to 16, but since I'm here, I'll just finish this slide and then we'll pause. In 16, we're looking at a protein acting as an enzyme. The purple thing is a protein. And as I said, proteins are catalysts. Well, a catalyst is a substance that speeds up a chemical reaction without actually being a reactant in that reaction. So think about what it means to be a reactant. In a chemical reaction, a reactant, or there can be more than one kind of reactant, gets turned into something else, right? Reactant gets turned into product. Well, a catalyst is not a reactant and therefore does not get turned into anything else. A catalyst simply helps reactants turn into products. Therefore, they speed up reactions. But because the catalyst is not a reactant, once it helps a reactant turn into a product, it's still there. It's reusable and able to do the same thing if there's more reactant. All right? We can see this right here. In general, how an enzyme works is that because of its shape, there is a particular place on the surface of the enzyme called the active site, which is just the proper shape to fit a particular kind of reactant. But if the reactant is using an enzyme, we call the reactant a substrate. So a substrate will only work with a particular kind of enzyme. It's based on shape. And when the substrate binds to the enzyme, we have the so-called enzyme-substrate complex. Something about that joining of the substrate and the enzyme cause the reaction to happen, which will, in this case, it's breaking something down. You could use an enzyme to build things up as well, but this one's breaking sucrose, table sugar, into its constituent monosaccharides, sucrose and fructose, which then get released from the enzyme, and that leaves the enzyme back in its original form, ready to do the same thing if there's more sucrose to be broken down. So catalysts are reusable. The catalytic converter of cars, which are often stolen, right? People get under cars and steal them because they're made of platinum, which is more valuable than gold. Well, that platinum is a catalyst for exhaust fumes. Turns bad stuff into not quite as bad stuff. But it's a catalyst, so it doesn't get used up. If something else doesn't happen to it, it'll last forever for the life of the car. But they're valuable because they're made of platinum. That's why they're getting stolen. Anyway, that's a hallmark of enzymes. All enzymes are catalysts. We just call them enzymes when it's an organism's protein that's acting as the catalyst, because they're all kind of industrial catalysts as well. That's enough for today.